Hi, everyone. My name's Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, everyone.
So nice to see so many people here. Before we start the meeting, which is healing through laughter, we're going to take a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. We'll do that now. Thank you. So now I think what we'll do is we'll go around the room and introduce ourselves, starting in the back. And no, but here we are, and this is the fifth step meeting, so I'll start with nine. Anyway, enough of that. It's really an honor to be here. It's an honor to have been asked to do anything for AA, really, and I was coming here anyway, and it's great that I was asked to chair this meeting. Healing through laughter, you know. I mean, I think most of the time I'm laughing at myself, and that's okay. You know, in AA, that's what we sort of learn how to do, to laugh at ourselves. You know, rule number 62, not to take myself so seriously, and not to take anything so seriously anymore. And I don't know, it's an amazing thing here that we have. I've laughed harder in sobriety than I ever did when I was drinking, and I continue to do that. I probably laugh at some point almost every day, and there is a lot of healing through that, I think. Anyway, enough for me. First off, Katie from Norman, Oklahoma. Let's hear it for Katie.
My name is Katie Wells, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since April 30th of 1999, and my home group is the Phoenix Group in Norman, Oklahoma. Oh, and I'm very glad to be here. Not real excited to be here, but please do not confuse that with not being honored. I am absolutely honored to be standing here today. I'm honored to be able to come to the International Conference. This is my second international. I was in Minneapolis in 2000. It's such an honor, and to be asked to participate at this conference is just an amazing honor and a blessing. I want to thank my friend Jill for submitting my name, and then however it happened, I have no idea, so thank the hat, whoever. But thank you for the opportunity, and it's really weird hearing your voice bouncing off the wall back there. Like, we can't hear what John was saying a whole lot right here, so... And I'm hearing myself coming back. I have prayed several times, and I have faith that God, I will say what God wants me to say. I'm ready for Him to kick in at any moment. Because I have no clue what I'm going to talk about. So if you need healing after this meeting, I apologize. Maybe there's a forgiveness talk that you could go to later. I guess for me, when I got here, there was nothing funny in my life. There was a lot of healing that needed to be done. I took myself very serious. I took everything very serious. Everything was very personal. It was all about me, the self-obsession, self-centered fear. It was all about me, and there was nothing funny about my life when I got here. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been praying for a long time for God to kill me in my sleep. And when I woke up the next day, I hated God because I was alive again, and He couldn't just put me out of my misery. So that was when I came into AA. I just came in as a shell of a human being. And I remember my mom telling me, and I thought about this recently, when I was younger, that when we were going to a trip, like to Disney World or a water park or something, how I would be excited on the inside. But she would say that, why don't you ever get excited about anything? Because I wouldn't show it. Now, if it was anger or fear, or if I got my feelings hurt, those negative emotions, I had no problem expressing those emotions. But I would be so excited on the inside, but I would never show that. I don't know why. I think it was self-obsession. You know, maybe I'm afraid of what they're going to think about me if I laugh at something that I'm not supposed to laugh at, or maybe I'm the only one in the room that's going to laugh at it, or, you know, it's inappropriate, and I don't have that problem here, for sure. But I would be excited about things, and my life wasn't bad. I don't want to say that I don't remember laughing before I got to AA. I did laugh when I got to AA. I had fun drinking for a little while, but the things that I laughed at, they were not, it didn't come from the heart. Maybe I was laughing just to fit in. I wasn't laughing much at myself. I hated myself when I got sober. If I laughed at someone else, it was laughing at them. It was not for the right reasons. So I do remember the first time I had that belly laugh, that like burning calories belly laugh. And I was in treatment at Valley Hope in Cushing, Oklahoma. And I don't remember what it was. Yay! Valley Hope alum. there's some. I don't remember what I laughed at. I remember their faces, the people that were there. We were out on the back porch and we were smoking probably our second carton that day. And I have no idea what was said, but I laughed so hard that night. My stomach hurt the next day. My face hurt. And there was such a healing. I didn't recognize it then. When I came into AA and I started to sit into more meetings, I realized, you know, that kind of laughter. I don't know what time I started, John. Dave. It's Dave. That's God's fault. He hasn't kicked in yet, so that's his fault. I didn't know your name. Okay, thank you. Dave. There you go. You laughed. It worked. So, anyway, first really hard laughter in treatment. The next time I started to experience a lot of laughter is when I got to know the women in my group. And I did not want to get to know you when I got sober. I maybe had a couple of friends, a couple of girlfriends, but I had a lot of guy friends when I got sober. And I know I'm not alone in that. Thank God. And so when I got here and I got a sponsor and she talked to me about having relationships with the women, and so I finally did, because I was desperate. I ended up, after being sober for a year in AA, not really doing much, I guess I was around AA, more miserable than I had been when I first got sober. And again, I was praying for God to kill me in my sleep at a year's sobriety. So when I finally got that desperation and I started doing what my sponsor suggested and I started developing the relationships with those women, and when we would hang out outside of the meeting, I would hear the things. They would talk about the things that we don't share in a general meeting. And those are the things that I could relate to, and we'd start telling our stories, and that's where the healing started for me, was with the women and the laughter and laughing at each other's stories. My sponsors that I've had in AA have always tried to teach me to not take myself so seriously. And when I go to them with a problem, it never fails that by the time we end the conversation or we hang up the phone, I'm laughing at myself. I'm laughing at that tragedy that I thought I had, that I called her for at 2 a.m. that was super important. And we hang up the phone laughing. I walk away from her laughing. And I'm so grateful for that. I love to have a good time. I know we all do. If I could still drink out there and have no consequences, this room would be empty. We know that. So we know we like to have a good time. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous I take dead serious, because it is just that. It is a matter of life and death for me and the people that I love. And I take it very serious. Carrying the message, I take extremely serious. And passing on what was given to me and not passing down a watered-down message is dead serious to me. outside of that, I like to have a good time. My home group likes to have a good time. We make up stupid excuses to hang out with each other outside of meetings, and we see each other all the time. And we have a good time. We chartered a bus, and there was about 40 of us on a bus on the way down here. And I laughed so hard on the way down here. I thought, oh, I don't have to go to bed the night before because I'll be sleeping for 9 hours on the bus. No. I still suffer from delusion. But we've had a great time. My family, we've always been humorous. My mom and I have a very twisted sense of humor. But I find that in AA also, very sick sense of humor. And we have a good time. I think the best part about AA is that we can laugh about our tragedies together. I love at speaker meetings, we celebrate our birthdays, our birthday nights on our speaker meeting nights, which are on Saturdays, every Saturday. And when we have families there, when someone's celebrating a birthday, I love to watch their expressions when someone's telling their story and we are falling out of our chairs laughing. And I've watched my parents, when someone's telling their story, you know, I burned down the house on Christmas Eve. Ah! Oh, it's hilarious. And I've seen my dad. Not funny, Katie. Not real funny. But the thing is, what I have to remember is it was not funny for them either. When I was out there, I know why our stories aren't funny. I'm so grateful that here we can laugh about those things because we've walked through them. They're in the past. We work on those things and we're moving forward. And I'm not saying that my parents aren't, or that if you're not in AA, you're not moving forward. And they have. You know, they have their daughter back and they're very grateful to AA. But I can respect how that might not be so. Some of that stuff is not so funny to them, so I try to keep it to myself. And not share it with them. I think I'm finished. I'm just so grateful to be here. I hope you all are having a wonderful, wonderful time. Enjoy the international conference. Thank you for allowing me to participate, and I love you all. Thank you for my life.
Thanks, Katie. That was fantastic. I was just thinking, about, you know, you're talking about laughing in treatment. I don't think I laughed once in treatment. I was not happy. I remember I went to treatment in Cleveland, Ohio. Anybody from Cleveland here? Cleveland. Yeah, Cleveland. All right, a couple people, whatever. That's where I live, Cleveland. And I remember I went to treatment, and it was in August, and not last August, but an August, a few Augusts ago, and hopefully not this August either. A day at a time. It was in August, and I didn't know what AA was. I didn't know what stopping drinking was. I didn't know what anything was. You know, I had no idea, and I showed up, and I went to treatment because I was in all this trouble, and you know, everybody was pretty upset with me, family and friends and whatever, and so I just wanted to get away for a while, and so I went to treatment, and it was August, and it was really hot in Cleveland, and I showed up, and I thought it was like summer camp, you know, I showed up with my guitar and my stereo, and, you know, I thought I was going away for like a 3-week little, you know, stay at summer camp, and that was not the case. They took my guitar away, and they took my CDs, and it's very disappointing, I know. I think I finagled a way to get my guitar back. I said I would use it, you know, to help the patients and, you know, play music. And I remember I was thinking about when I was in treatment, I knew nothing about AA, and we were playing AA trivia one night, which was great for me. And I think I got the question, when was the big book written or something like that? I didn't even know what the big book was, but, you know, so it was on me, and I had to guess. So I think I said 1984, so that was... Is that right? I don't know. I guess it wasn't right. They all had a good laugh at me, but that's okay. Anyway, next up, from New York, John.
I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. My sobriety date is April 23rd, 2003. Wow. I'm really grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be sober today. Because I didn't want to come here. You know, like a lot of other people, I just thought AA was the end of your life. You know, you end up in church basements talking about your problems, and I didn't want to do that. And I knew my life was unmanageable, and I was powerless, but I wanted to be the one, you know, to make the decisions. And, you know, if I was going to make it, if it was going to be a mess, at least it was my mess. You know, so today it's a lot different. Anyway, I'll just tell you my story. I started drinking when I was 13, and I loved it. You know, I have memories of, like, being out in the snow. I grew up in New Jersey, northern Jersey. I can remember, like, being out in the snow, having, like, a Tupperware thing of, like, Kool-Aid and vodka, and, like, chugging that and then rolling around in the snow in my T-shirt just like, ah, I love this. Basically, every decision I made after that was bad. I dropped out of high school. I loved drinking, you know. That's what it was. I just loved drinking, and everything I did was like the way we talk about what we do between AA meetings. It was what I did between drinking. I just, it's crazy. A lot of blackouts early on, 14 years old, blacking out. And I woke up on like golf courses and in the woods. I learned how to drink when I was like 14. What I learned was don't pass out around your friends. Because I see like people's like eyebrows get shaved off and stuff. So I knew if I could just get outside, I'd be safe, you know. So I was always waking up in the woods. And so I didn't care about blacking out because, you know, nothing terrible really ever. I don't remember, so it's okay. My parents, you know, I have beautiful parents. I love them both today. I have a good relationship with them. At the time, I just, you know, I didn't care about them. But they kind of told me, you know, that people take different paths in life. Some people go to college. Other people, you know, get a career. And I just wasn't happy with those two options. So I was like, well, I don't know, man. There's got to be another way, you know. So I was into, like, fixing cars. And I had a 69 Firebird. And I had a 68 Malibu. And I built one car out of the two, and I called it the Malibird. And I jacked it up real high with air shocks. I painted a skull and crossbones on the hood in gold spray paint. Me and another guy, we built this car, and I don't know if you know anything about cars. It had no exhaust, so it was loud, you know? And it shot flames out the back. And we took it down to Miami. This was the big plan. I had these bonds that my grandparents bought, and when, you know, for me to go to college when I was a baby or something. I cashed these things in. I had like $2,000. I thought I hit the lottery. And we took this car and we drove from. It had New York plates at that time, and we drove to Miami. And we got pulled over every single day driving down 95. And they were always the same thing, you know, and we drank. This guy drank like I drank. We drank all the time. There were empties in a car. But they would search the car, and they were looking for guns and drugs. And they didn't care about the empties, you know. They would just say, all right, go home, or wherever you're from. And I had long hair, and he had long hair, and he was kind of a weirdo, like me, you know. He was like into like heavy metal. I was more of a hippie, you know. So he wore like all leather, and he had his guitar, and he had it plugged into the car stereo, and he would like play, you know. Anyway, we got down to Miami. We stayed at a friend's house, and after 2 weeks, this guy's girlfriend was like, these two guys gotta go. I mean, we were just, you know, drinking and having fun and running out of money, and he was supposed to get some money from this settlement. So she kicked us out, and we went down to the Everglades, and we were camping out in the Everglades. And there's a lot of bugs in the Everglades. I got stung by like 28 different kinds of bugs. I was like, And we only had this two-person pup tent, you know. But we were like, it's Florida. We don't need a tent. So, like, the two of us in there. You know? And we had, like, a couple cases of beer. And we were eating coconuts. And we were waiting for this guy to get this settlement. And he got it, you know. After a while, after, like, eating coconuts for weeks, it was like, oh, let's get out of here. But he got the money. And we thought it was going to be another $2,000. It ended up being like $10,000. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah. We were like, forget about Miami. Let's go to California. Now we traded in that two-man pup tent for an eight-man tent. Well, then we had some space. And we drove this car across the country. It got 8 miles to the gallon. And it took us 3 months. And at the end of that trip, I can tell you this. I knew that he was an alcoholic. For sure. That guy blacked out all over the place. You know, it's funny because about 2 years ago, he found me on one of these social networking sites. And he's sober in AA. He's got about 16 years now. Yeah, it's awesome. And he said to me, what are the chances that the two of us both made it to AA? I mean, that we're both alive. It's amazing. It's beautiful. My heart fills with so much gratitude. And anyway, so we got to talking, and he's talking about this trip we took, and I don't know what the hell he's talking about. I go, holy crap, I must have been passed out and blacked out half of the trip, too. How the two of us made it across is amazing. So I have this whole other memories. And it's all of him being trashed. And he has all these memories of me being trashed. So anyway, I jump ahead a bunch of years. I spent a lot of years traveling. I got weirder and stranger. I grew my hair longer and longer. And I started tying like locks in my hair. And, you know, this was the life that I was looking for. No responsibility, no job, just driving around. I started going to Grateful Dead concerts, selling burritos. And it was always like enough money to like get beer and to, you know, get gas. And, you know, that car, I blew the engine. I ended up living in a van and station wagon and, you know, doing a lot of geographics. I've been all over the country and don't remember any of it really. But anyway, you know, eventually I found myself back on the East Coast and I lived in Maryland for a while, working on cars. Anyway, I've lived all over the place. There's probably, I could get a whole place cheering after a while. I came back to New York, and my drinking was really progressed. I was drinking daily. I was starting to have some problems around that. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew that I might have to settle down. You know, I might have to cut my hair. You know, because it was really hard to get a job, put rocks in your hair. But I was looking for a job. It was in New York, and I wanted a job where I could live and travel, you know. Well, not necessarily travel, but live. And I interviewed with a guy with a tugboat, because I could live on a tugboat. And I interviewed with the circus. And the circus called first. And I got to say now that I ran away with the circus. And, wow, man, I found my people, my tribe, you know. They drank like I drank, you know. And I found, like, at first I was just drinking with, like, the young guys who were all drinking Colt 45 on the lot, you know. And then eventually I found the guys that were a little older like me, and they were going to the bars. And that's when I started really hitting the bars. And I started, I don't know, for whatever reason, I started drinking VO. This is like a drink. I just like drinking it. I'm like a creature of habit. When I find something I like, I just stick with it. Like when I got sober, I started eating bacon, egg, and cheeses in the morning. And been eating them ever since. Every day, this guy at the bodega where I live, you know, he knows. He sees me coming, he makes the thing. But, you know, I went with the circus, and I traveled around with them, and you know, I just, like, thought I had arrived, you know. I'm never going to lose this job. Eventually, I was in an accident, and just some injuries in my back, and I lost that job. I just happened to be in New York when that happened. And my family over the years, I had little contact with them. I have some sisters and my parents. And when I got hurt and I was in New York and I was on workman's comp, I started collecting a check. They started seeing me a little bit and realized, I guess I was the last person to know that I had a problem, you know. And they kind of, I made a call to my sister one time. Well, I should say, like, when I lost that job, I had nowhere to go. My family did a little tough love with me. And so I was living in the street. And, I always thought, well, I traveled all over the country. I lived in a car. Who cares? I could live in the street. So it's not so fun in New York. But, you know, I tried, like, living in the park because I was like, well, it's like almost like the woods. And but there's a lot of weirdos in the park at night, myself included, you know. And during this time, I started going in and out of detoxes. And it's kind of like you said, like you showed up with your guitar. I got to be like a professional detox goer. You know, I showed up with my pajamas, my own slippers, my own pillow, you know, because I didn't want to wear the paper slippers. I knew better than you guys, you know. And, you know, anyway, I made this call to my sister one time. She lived in California, and I said, you got to send me some money. You know, I'm in a bad way. And I was always in a bad way. I always needed money, you know. And she said, I remember she was crying on the phone. She said, John, I love you. Please go get help. And I just, like, so ashamed. Or what I really heard was, I'm not going to send you money. You know? But I had a lot of shame over that kind of stuff, you know. And that kind of shame and my pride and all this kind of stuff kept me out there a long time. You know, the way I got to AA is I was, I would go back and forth from being on the street. Where I was when I got in AA, I was living in a van in Brooklyn, New York, with two flat tires that I pushed back and forth for alternate street, you know, parking. So my mental capacity wasn't that great, you know. Oh, and the van was full of treasure that I believed was treasure. And so I didn't even lay down in the seat because of all this stuff I had in the back. And about 3 years into sobriety, I had this memory that these other homeless people broke into the van and didn't take anything. You know? So I have to come to see my own insanity, you know. But I still believe that I could fix myself, or if I wasn't, I mean, at that point in my life, I was like 35, 34, 35, and I was hopeless. I had come to accept in myself that I wasn't going to fix myself, and that there was no hope for me, and that this was going to keep going on and keep getting worse and worse, and I'd end up down on the Bowery. I'd been to the Bowery. There's this place on the Bowery called the Bowery Mission, and you go there, and they make you sit through a mass before they feed you, and I'd been to that place because I do the kind of things you do when you're homeless in a big city. You know, you go to missions, and you go to places to get food, and you sleep on chairs where they won't let you lay down, even though the floor is right there. But nobody's laying on it, you know. But being mad at them, I'm the one that can't take care of myself, you know. But, I was walking in the city one day, and I walked by this church, and there were these, I used to sleep on this park bench, like one block from this church. And I was walking by, and there was always this plate glass window. And this one day, never knew this, that there was like doors behind that window. The doors were open, and I looked in, and there was, you know, chairs set up. And I'd been enough detoxes, and I'd been around AA. I don't know, you know, I'm like, I had gone to meetings, although I never really paid attention. And I looked in there, and I saw the chairs, and I knew it was an AA meeting, and I walked in. And a guy handed me a meeting book. And he circled meetings that he went to. I don't know how he knew. I was new. You know, I was carrying everything I owned in a backpack. I probably hadn't taken a shower in 2 weeks, you know. I didn't ever look at anybody. I didn't trust anyone. I was not trustworthy myself. I would steal from you in a heartbeat. And I had like a sort of code of honor. If I was walking on the street and your car was unlocked, that was free. I could take it. If your car was locked, I would leave it alone. It was like, in my mind, this was like, you know, rational thinking. You know, you left it your mistake and my opportunity. But, you know, I went to meetings then and I started counting days and I met a guy. He told his story and he said in his qualification that he sponsored guys and he had an opening for a sponsee. So I just went up and stood next to the guy after the meeting. I was incapable of asking for help, you know. And he just looked at me, and he pulled out a big book out of his bag or whatever, and he said, "I'm your sponsor. Read the first 164 pages of this book. Call me tomorrow." I was like, "All right, whatever." And I went. What's amazing to me is I went to that van where I was living, and I started reading that book. I hated it, but I kept reading it. And what's like really amazing is I didn't throw it in the back with all my other treasure. You know, I just. It had some impact on me. I had never really thought too much about God. I never really thought too much about this kind of stuff. And shortly after that was my first day and was my last drink. And I came to, on April 23rd, 2003, I went to a meeting. And I put my hand up and I said, "I surrender." And that was like the beginning for me. I don't know where that came from. You know, it came from the book. I was reading a book, I guess, and something came through, and my life began to change. And I'll just tell this one other story, because my sponsor at that time, he told me, you know, like, "Are you willing to go to any length?" And I said yes. So anyway, I'll just tell you, when we got to the third step, I was walking with him in Times Square in the city, and I said something to him like, you know, are we going to, you know, I don't know, I was ready to move on. I didn't know anything about the steps. I didn't know anything about AA. And he said, "Are you ready for the third step?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm ready." He goes, "All right, let's get on our knees." It's the middle of Times Square. I'm like, "Get on my knees." He got the book out, and he's like, "We're going to do the third step prayer right here in Times Square." He goes, "I'm willing to go to any length." So I'm like, "All right." So that's my third step story. I got and did that right there and did the prayer and was looking over my shoulder. I want to thank you all for my sobriety.
Thanks, John. That was great. I used to wake up on golf courses, too. And I was thinking you were talking about following a band around and selling burritos, and I was actually just doing that last week, so maybe I should call my sponsor. I don't know. Whoops. Anyway, great story, and a great story of recovery, too. And our last speaker for today, for this meeting, is Teresa from Montana.
Hello. My name is Teresa Klotz, and I am an alcoholic. And this is so amazing, I can't even tell you. Thanks to God, Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship, I'm sober since May 24th of 1988. And I'm extremely grateful for that, and I'm extremely grateful to be here and somewhat grateful to be standing in my shoes right at this present moment. But, you know, this isn't about me. Really, there's nothing, not one single thing special about me other than I have a horrible case of alcoholism. And something happened to me along the way where I got sober and eventually, you know, against my better judgment, maybe. Started working the steps and began to recover. And today, my life is very, very different than what it was. I was in the shower this morning thinking, it's like, man, when I live in Helena, Montana. My home group is the Last Chance Recovery Group. And woohoo! And when I moved to Montana, long story how that all came to pass, I knew one person. And that was 1991, and today is 2010, and I know people from all over the country. You know, some of them are my dear close friends, some of them are acquaintances, some are people that I've gotten to know a little here, a little here, a little here from just coming back and taking these actions, and it's just quite overwhelming. But it didn't start there, right? Okay, so it started out in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I am raised by Dick and Phyllis. They're nice, stable, reasonable, responsible people. And there was a lot of polyester in my home. There was a lot of, like, my dad had these, he had a brush cut, and my mom had salt and pepper hair, and she would tape her curly cues to her cheek before she went to bed every night, and she slept on a satin pillow, and oh, merciful heaven, right? And my dad wore polyester leisure suits with the top stitching, with the jackets and the pants and the vest were all interchangeable, right? And family pictures of plaids going in every different direction. And oh mercy, we were not cool at all. And I, you know, I was not beaten or abused or harmed in that family. They really were such a fine example of how to live in the world and take care of your neighbors and, you know, discipline and love and food on the table and clean clothes in the closet and all of that. And I just was such a colossal dork. I just was always so uncomfortable. I just hated who I was, how I looked. I was always, if I could be somebody else, I would be A-okay. And what happened to me was in seventh grade, I went on a babysitting job one night. And that was a great gig. They paid well. You could have a friend over. And so me and my friend Jamie were there, and we put their daughter to bed, and we came back down to the living room, family room, to watch TV, really, and just hang out. And honestly, we had no intention for mayhem going into that babysitting job, but we came back down to their family room, and on our way through the dining room, there was a box of, like, open half-gallon bottles of who cares what. And we just, you know, it's like in the cartoons, right? When the clouds open and the sunbeam comes down, it goes, ooh, and you just go, ooh. You know, we're like seventh grade girls, and we've hit the mother load. And we just went and got some big glasses out of the kitchen and started pouring drinks, you know, making tequila sunrise with Sunkissed Pop or Orange Crush or some crap like that. And we got so rip-roaring, stinking drunk all over their house. My friend Jamie threw up in their bed. It was bad. It was bad, bad. Here's alcoholism, right? Because I felt like I was in absolute total control of that evening. And I just, all I could do really was chase her through the house going, no, no, not the bed. And that's kind of how the night went. And eventually I had to call my mother from her Sons of Norway penny ante poker game, you know, and come and help me. And she came and collected my friend and took her home, and those people came home that night and found their babysitter passed out on the couch in their living room. And they didn't know what happened. You know, the mom packed me into the car and the dad took me home, and my mom was mortified that I took their money. And you know, and really, by all rights, it ended badly that night, except that I have alcoholism, and my life changed for the better. You know, everybody else around me was miserably displeased, and but I felt great. I didn't get sick. I felt my friend Jamie was one of the most popular girls in my school. I felt superior to her. It was just like all the planets aligned, and I was fantastic. You know, it was just like, whoa. The first deep breath I'd probably taken my entire life. And I did other things, and I didn't become a daily drinker. I was in seventh grade, but every opportunity I had, I babysat for a lot of people one time. I just was a train wreck. And I didn't care. And in between all of that, you know, I did some other things. I am also very much a lightweight. I cannot drink. I couldn't drink hard liquor. That's my great shame. I don't think I've ever drank Jack Daniels. That makes me sad. But I'm ridiculous. What did we do? So we drank, you know, the classic vodka, because we think no one can tell. So I drank a lot of, I threw up a lot of screwdrivers. I thought for a long time, believed wholeheartedly from head to toe that I was allergic to citrus, because I just couldn't keep down a screwdriver. I just couldn't do it. And I didn't have to have a citrus sponsor. I just stayed away from it for years and years. I think finally I was a couple years sober when I had an orange and went, oh, look at that, I didn't vomit. Isn't that amazing? It's just, you know, the stupid things that we tell ourselves and then we believe it. And we go, well, of course. It's like I thought I had a hormone imbalance because every time I drank at a bar, I might go to the bar alone, but I never left the bar alone. You know, and I did not go to a doctor to pursue any of this stuff. I just kind of, you know, pieced it all together and went, well, obviously, it's hormones. And it's just ridiculous. So things like that, that kind of thing happened to me a lot. And my parents were there, you know, with one eyebrow raised a lot of the time, trying to figure it out. They didn't get that I was alcoholic. My mom has an alcoholic brother who was, you know, died from alcoholism. And on the relative scale of what does an alcoholic look like, I don't look like my Uncle Johnny. I just don't. And so it was very difficult for my parents to get what was even going on. But there were many times where I was, you know, I would leave the house with my friends and go to the bar and come back in broad daylight, you know, just too trashed to get from the car to the door. And they would prop me up against the house and ring the doorbell and dash because they didn't want to face my parents. And I would just kind of fall in the door and they would try to get me on the couch with a wastebasket under my face and wait till I came around, and, you know, just things like that. Or I moved home a lot. You know, I'm 18 and I'm independent, and I would move off and get a place, and then I would get into a jackpot there, and I would whine to my mother, and she'd say, well, you can always come home. And my dad would go, Phyllis, you know, quit saying that. We were free. And so I would come home again for a little bit until there were rules and you're not sleeping in your bed at night and you're worrying your mother and I can't have this and okay, fine. And off I would go until a few months later I would be whining to my mother and she'd say, you can always come home. And it just went on and on like that. And I mean, really, that is the gist of my drinking story. I take a drink and I get drunk and I cat around and pair off with some poor guy at closing time, you know, hi, God, are you alone? And honestly, and it just went on and on like that. It's really nothing very interesting ever happened to me, although every time it felt different, right? And years later, when I was doing a sex inventory and wrote all of that stuff in black and white on paper and saw this very premeditated pattern of how I conducted myself in the world, and I was absolutely shocked. It's like that part in Bill's story where he says, I woke up, this had to be stopped, and I really got that. You know, he meant it. But powerless to do anything different. And I can tell you that not drinking never really entered the picture, but changing my behavior and doing other things. The last time I picked up someone in the bar, I had my big plan. Here's my plan. This is how brilliant I am. I won't shave my legs because that would be tacky to pick up a stranger if you weren't clean shaven. You're right, Teresa. That's brilliant. And that was my whole plan, right? So I went to the bar. I went with these women. I did not want to embarrass myself in front of these women. I didn't know them very well. And at 2 o'clock that morning, I was in some strange man's bathroom borrowing a razor. Right? So, I mean, and that wasn't even like a fly-by-night plan. That was given much thought and consideration plan. And I was the only one surprised to find myself in that guy's bathroom in the middle of the night. It's bizarre. And so not very long after that, you know, I was at home drunk alone. You know, I had a little baby. She was 2 years old, and I'm passed out every night in front of the TV. And I'm getting up and going to work in the morning and trying to impersonate a normal person. And if you've ever tried to do that, it's quite exhausting. You know, one day at a time, day after day. I couldn't drink at lunch because I couldn't make it till 5 o'clock to finish the drunk. It was just torture. There's no virtue involved. I just couldn't go that long once I triggered the allergy. I just need to drink. And somewhere in there, a friend of mine who was my last drinking buddy, I was whining to her about my life, and she said, you know, Teresa, these things only seem to happen to you when you've been drinking. And I thought, why, yes, that seems true. And so I went to treatment, outpatient treatment, and my response to a life of abstinence every night after treatment on the way home was to consider driving my car off the Mendota Bridge. I was just, oh, I can't, how am I going to do this? You know, for somebody who doesn't think I rely and depend on alcohol, how am I going to have dinner with my family? How am I going to get through the night? How am I going to watch TV? How am I going to chirp right? You know, and the only reason, I don't know, I thought about killing myself a lot. I prayed for a lot for God to take me in my sleep and woke up very angry. I really, to come from that place where I just flatly didn't want to be here, and no exaggeration, but too cowardly to act on it, to be in a life that is beyond my wildest dreams, and there's really nothing special about me. Am I good? All right. I got to get the heck out of Minneapolis because that was the scene of the crime for me. And I worked for a company that was moving their operations to New York City. I was also drinking a lot of near beer while I was going through treatment. Whoa. You know, if you ever had, go to a bar, drink a few Mousies or Duels and watch everybody around you laugh and joke and pair off and dance and have fun. And you can just, you know, imagine them bursting into flame before your very eyes. That was, and believing that I was sober that entire time. And today I understand very clearly that people like me, a woman who sponsored me for a long time said, non-alcoholic beer is for non-alcoholics. And I can't drink. I cannot take alcohol safely in any form. And for me, I never drank enough to get drunk off of that stuff. I only got amazingly angry and hateful. You know, it's like really. And I started coming around AA meetings, but I refused to participate. I refused to get a sponsor. I refused to get a home group. I'm not that bad. I have no DUI. I have no STD. I've never vomited blood. Get away from me. And I, I just didn't drink. And I came to some meetings, and what happened to me is what happens to an untreated alcoholic, is we just get weirder one day at a time, right? Weirder and weirder and weirder. And that's how you recognize us. We're the wackiest ones in the room, the ones who flatly refuse to lift a finger to participate in our own recovery. And I moved off to New York City, and I lived there for a couple of years, and I got still crazier. And people tried to help me. People tried to get me involved. People reached out to me. People tried to sponsor me, but I was just so all-knowing, all-powerful, and somewhere in there, when I was about a year dry, I was on my way to the grocery store with my daughter, and a gentleman mugged me and came up behind me, got his arm around my throat, and said, "Give me all your money." And he got me down on the ground really before I even knew what happened, and I explained to him that my money was inside my jacket, sir, and you will have to let me up if you want my money. And he made the foolish error of letting me up. And because I haven't had a drink for like a year, right? And I haven't worked a step to save my soul. And I've been going to some counseling where the only relief I got was when they handed me tennis rackets to wail on sofa cushions until the room was full of dust. And then she said, "Oh, our time is up. You'll have to go." And I was like, oh, my God. Right? So that's what that man chose that day on that street. And he let me up, and my feet hit the concrete, and I came undone all over him. People believed it was a domestic dispute. They thought I knew him intimately. And really, I was a victim. Really, officer. It's just, you know. So after that, I assessed that New York City was a dangerous place, and packed up my stuff, and I knew someone who would give me a job in Helena, Montana, and I moved my daughter out there. And really, my plan was to meet a cowboy or a lumberjack. That was my whole plan. I had a job. Now I just need to find love. You know, it'd be like the X-Files meets the Waltons or something. It's just ridiculous. And I did, you know, but the other thing that happened, I mean, I didn't meet a cowboy or a lumberjack. I met a Colombian. And it just goes on from there. But the other thing that happened to me in the midst of all of that is I wandered into a very enthusiastic group of Alcoholics Anonymous where people were carrying the message, where people knew what alcoholism is, and they were not one bit shy about sharing their own experience, drinking, not drinking, and working the steps. And there was a cute guy in that meeting, and that's what kept me coming back. And the woman who asked me, who I asked to be my sponsor, you know, she was talking in the meeting one day, and she described herself as feeling like a turd that floated to the top of a tank. And that's what I related to. You know, that was the hook to get me. It was just that. And I, because really, if you looked at the circumstances of my life, things weren't horrible. I had a job. I had custody of my child. Seemingly good things happened to me. I had money in the bank and car insurance and all of these things, but I just want to be dead every single day. And I try to act like a nice, normal lady, but I'm a toon. I'm just a looney tune. And I started showing up at that woman's house, you know, once a week with our book across her kitchen table, and she started sharing her experience. She took me through the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. She taught me to be able to recognize alcoholism, my alcoholism, to look back through my story, drinking, not drinking, all of it, and shared her own experience enough to convince me that I have this thing. That really is the gist, is I need to know that I have your problem. If I don't identify with your problem, then I have absolutely no need for your solution. And I really need your solution. I mean, it's like anybody that looked at me is like, whoa, sister needs some solution. And that woman grabbed me. You know, just with that little description was enough to keep me coming to her kitchen table. And it just started to explain what had been going on in my life the last 2.5 years that I had not been drinking and not participating in the program of recovery that's offered to us here. I really was crazy. And that is today why I am fortunate and privileged and lucky and everything that goes with it to be standing here in the condition that I'm in, and to have God and you people, you men and women, have taken my sordid, ratty past and turned it to good account. Because there are things that I've done that I'm ashamed of that really intended to go to the grave. And I'm able to share those with new women and encourage them to keep coming back. And we all start to laugh about where we come from, because you know what? I'm not living it today. Today I'm faithful and monogamous to my husband. I'm a good mother to my daughter. I'm a wonderful daughter to my mother. I'm not a cause of concern for that woman anymore. And my boss thinks I have integrity. You know, I mean, none of these things were going on when I first got here. So having said all of that, it is such a privilege to be here among you. I want to thank Rick for sending me that letter and my delegate for putting my name on the list. And, you know, whatever it took to get me on the plane and to make all of this happen, it's just a beautiful thing to be a part of. So sweetheart deal, right? Don't stop now. Keep coming back. It really does work. Thanks.